Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
At this point, what's a couple of billion dollars between friends, right? Remember that big loss at JPMorgan Chase? Oh, it's a lot bigger now. Hear what Jamie Dimon had to say about it on the broadcast today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Friday. It's the 13th of July. Glad you could be with us. JPMorgan Chase had its second quarter earnings conference call today. Started pretty early, 7:30 in New York. Unspeakably early out here in California. So we set up our voicemail to record the choicest bits from CEO Jamie Dimon.
At the tone, record your greeting. At the end of your greeting, press pound.
We are not proud of this moment, but we are proud of our company. Obviously, this one, we shot ourselves in the foot. In spite of this accident, we've had hundreds of people kind of working around the clock now for 3 months to get this thing fixed. And we think we have a very disciplined and detailed management team, all of whom are sorry that we missed this thing. We've learned a lot. I can tell you this has shaken our company to the core. Hopefully, after this is over, we will be a stronger company for it.
Your greeting has been recorded. Goodbye.
Mr. Dimon and his losses are where we begin today. What we had thought was $2 billion in losses from trades gone bad, we now know to be almost $6 billion, 5.8 to be precise. And Dimon said this morning he's not sure that's the end of it, but it is where we will start our wrap of the 5 days gone by. Today's usual suspects are John Carney from CNBC. He's in New York. And a rare in-studio appearance with me here in Los Angeles by Felix Salmon. He's from Reuters. Hey, guys.
Hello, Kai.
Hello.
All right. So, John, JPMorgan Chase, is it going to get bigger, first of all?
Yes, it's going to grow. The losses are not contained. JPMorgan still hasn't completely exited the positions. It might not get much bigger than this, but it has the potential to get bigger.
Felix, what do you think?
It won't get more than $1 billion bigger. And frankly,
pocket change.
Frankly, when you're the size of JP Morgan, you can lose $1 billion down the back of the sofa.
Yeah, but come on. This isn't about the actual dollar amount of the loss, right, Felix?
This is about the out-of-control traders in London who are gambling hundreds of billions of dollars of JP Morgan's money, which is deposited with the bank by American depositors, right, guaranteed by the U.S. government, and then JP Morgan ships it off to London and gambles it.
And to make things even worse, the traders are lying to their superiors and getting away with lying for quite a bit of time about how much the losses were. I reported on CNBC today that the traders had actually told their bosses that they only had $12 million in losses when the number was actually 20 times that. This is a terrible thing for JP Morgan. That kind of loss shouldn't be allowed to happen without somebody hearing about it.
Yeah, well, and we are, right? But Felix, you heard Jamie Dimon in the tape there. He called it an accident. I mean, come on.
This was out of control. Traders in London without adult supervision. Right. The woman ultimately in charge of them, Ina Drew, was, you know, she had Lyme disease. She didn't really know what was going on. And they basically just could do whatever they wanted and no one stopped them.
Yeah. John, what's going to quickly, and then we'll move off on off this subject because I think we've all heard too much about it, frankly. What happens now? Anything?
I think that there's going to be a hard look inside of JP Morgan because although they sounded very confident that this isn't happening anywhere else in the bank, there is a question of whether it's too big to manage. If this could happen in this unit, could it happen anywhere else? We don't know.
Yeah. All right. We're going to stay in London, actually. That's where this whole trading thing went bad for JP Morgan. We're going to talk about LIBOR, the big scandal from a week ago, Barclays manipulating the rate and what that says about banks gone crazy. Felix, there is more to come on this story, I'm sure, right?
Today we saw a whole bunch of documents released by the New York Fed because the New York Fed has been talking to traders. That's what they do. That's what their job is. And they've been recording those calls and taking transcripts. And it turns out that the New York Fed was talking very explicitly to people at Barclays who said, yeah, we're lying about LIBOR and so is everybody else. And if the New York Fed knew this, it's kind of implausible that UK regulators didn't. Right. But either way, the New York Fed really should have done something.
Well, all right. So, John, two things. One, what could they have done? And number two, let's remember this was back when Timothy Geithner was the head of the New York Fed. But what could they have done, John?
I don't think there's well, first of all, I think what they should have done is said, look, you guys, we need to put honest numbers in here. But we should also tell people, you know, if the lying that took place at the height of the financial crisis, LIBOR was never meant to be a sort of standalone measure of bank health. So what they could have done is said, look, we are going to change the way we do LIBOR, or we're going to ask you guys to start putting in more honest numbers. The way that it apparently was done, however, was we're going to allow you to keep putting in dishonest numbers, not tell anybody that that's what's happening, allow people to mistakenly use it as a measure of bank health. And I think that's a disaster. I think it and erodes to be fair, trust. Wait.
Yeah. OK, Felix, hang on a second, because here's the deal. We have now spent the last 3 minutes and 40 something seconds talking about banks lying, about fraud, about bankers doing irresponsible things with other people's money. Felix, does that not boggle the mind?
And the really sad thing is it doesn't boggle my mind at all.
Oh,
it comes
come
as
on.
No surprise whatsoever to learn that people whose bonuses
you have become
are dependent
cynical and jaded,
on
my
lying
friend.
And manipulating are going to be lying and manipulating.
John Carney, you.
I think this is a very bad story for the entire world economy. I am not as cynical as Felix is, and I sure actually is. Was shocked to see that the lying that was going on at Barclays was as regular and as explicit, and I expect we're going to hear that the same sort of thing was happening at a number of banks across the world.
How many, Felix? Half a dozen? A dozen more banks?
I think all of them. Barclays was at the top, and it was keeping its rates down. There were 16 altogether. I think all of them did it.
John, you think all of them did it?
I think so. There are 16. I would say if it was less than 14 that was lying, I would be surprised.
Wow. Unbelievable. John Carney from CNBC in New York. Felix Salmon from Reuters. He's here in L.A. with me today. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you.
Thanks.
If you want to know more, sorry, John, to step on you. If you want to know more about what Jamie Dimon said today or how J.P. Morgan is actually doing, our New York bureau chief, Heidi Moore, has just the thing for you. Her explainer, it's called J.P. Morgan's Terrible, No Good, Very Bad Trading Loss, is on our website, marketplace.org. On Wall Street this Friday, a pretty good, not bad at all, trading day. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Today's Money and Politics story comes to us with a like father, like son twist to it. Jonathan Soros, son of liberal financier George, is taking after dad by funding a political project of his own. Soros the Younger says he wants to reduce the influence of big money in politics. And bear with me now, because this is where the story gets a little bit weird. The way he's going to fight super PACs is by launching a super PAC. Marketplace's Mark Garrison tries to make some sense of it.
That's the sound of a big guy thrown to the mat in a martial arts gym. It's what the younger Soros and his allies want to do to politicians who oppose campaign finance limits. It's kind of like what Henner Gracie teaches his jiu-jitsu students, including Tim Tebow.
Use the opponent's energy, power, and athleticism against them.
So if the enemy runs super PACs, start one of your own. The Soros super PAC is called Friends of Democracy, and Elise Hoag is the co-director. She recognizes the irony of what they're doing, but says they have to in a political system flooded with cash.
The political elite are responsive to whether or not they believe they're going to be elected. And right now, outside money is what governs that response and stimulus, and that's how we've got to make the change.
She says the super PAC will run media campaigns against congressmen who favor unlimited spending. So far, their targets are all Republicans, but Hoag says they could also go after Democrats. Federal Election Commission veteran Bob Bierzak, now senior fellow at the Center for Responsive Politics, doesn't think their plan will fly.
People have tried before to use campaign finance as an issue in a campaign, especially in Congress, and it's generally not successful.
The super PAC wants to raise $8 million to run ads in around a dozen House districts this fall. And if you don't agree with the Soros-funded anti-super PAC super PAC, you could always start a counter anti-super PAC super PAC super PAC. It's perfectly legal. I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
The technology industry is full of Cinderella stories. Startups like Instagram selling for $1 billion. Facebook being Facebook. But there are plenty of companies that misread the moment and miss their chances. Groupon, anybody? Or Dig, one of the earliest social media sites. What's left of Dig is said to have sold yesterday for $500,000, maybe a little bit more, which is nice, but nowhere near the hundreds of millions it used to be worth. Here's the question, though. How do you know when it's your moment? Marketplace's Queen Akim explains when it comes to social media, at least, timing really is everything.
When Dig launched in 2004, it was a startup darling. It let users post links of their favorite news and websites. Then their friends could vote the link up or down. In its heyday, the site got 14 million visitors and a line of offers. Google reportedly offered $200 million in 2008, but no deal was ever done. So that 500,000 selling point has got to hurt.
There's no balloon that goes off or a siren that sounds.
Robert Hendershot teaches entrepreneurship at Santa Clara University. He says despite the caveat, there are signs. One company that read them right was MySpace, which sold itself to News Corp for $580 million in 2005. Then it tanked. News Corp eventually sold it for just $36 million. Hendershot says MySpace probably looked in the rearview mirror and saw Facebook coming quickly. And so investors made their exit.
Facebook was clearly going to surpass them. And once you see that, now is the time to consider getting out of this investment.
But things aren't always that clear. Toby Stewart teaches entrepreneurship at UC Berkeley's Business School. He says the shelf life of social media companies is determined by their audience, and they can be fickle.
And people move very, very quickly off of these platforms because for most of them, there are very few what we call switching costs.
The switching cost? Typing in a new address into your browser and leaving that old one behind. In San Francisco, I'm Queenie Kim for Marketplace.
Among the many things that are changing as we adjust to this post-financial crisis new economic normal is the idea of retirement. Commentator Chris Farrell says we ought to just get over it.
We all know the American retirement dream. After 30 years, you collect your gold watch, sell your home and move, preferably somewhere sunny. That's what the character Ben Huggins did in this 1961 promotion for a new retirement community, Sun City, Arizona.
I've finally made it. No more hurry, no more pressure. From now on, I'm going to enjoy myself.
The retire and move lifestyle emerged after World War II. Middle-class Americans had enough financial independence to retire to the Sun Belt. Men like Ben Huggins and their wives played golf in the morning and enjoyed cocktails at night.
Sun City, an active new way of life.
Well, for most of us, those days are over. Gold watch? Forget it. Retirement savings? Slim to none. These days, most people aren't even planning to retire. They'll work until at least 70. And because people are working longer, they're not moving like they used to. Today, retirement's been replaced by staytirement. But staying put is a savvy choice because it reflects both a desire to work and the need to make money. Here's the thing. Jobs come largely from friends, colleagues, and acquaintances. Workers spend years building their networks. And those networks are the key to a part-time consulting gig, a job at a local business, or a place at a nonprofit organization. So, come 65, a retirement move from the Twin Cities to Orlando or Boston for a Corpus Christi might sound alluring, but it will make that priceless community network suddenly worthless. And without the backstop to retirement that a network represents, the prospect of a long life after 65 looks a lot less comfortable. Moving used to be a good investment for a retiree to make, but for this new generation of retirees, it's a bad play.
Chris Farrell appears regularly on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, which this weekend looks to put a price on aging. Straight ahead, I wonder what's up with Europe today.
It's been 20 years since the last car maker closed a factory in France, and this is a very symbolic change. It is a huge symbolic shock.
But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, so Friday the 13th turned out to be a lucky day for investors after six straight losses for the Dow Jones Industrial Average. The blue chips finally reversed course in a very big way. They surged 203 points, nearly 1 2/3%. The closing number, 12,777. Lucky sevens there, I guess. The NASDAQ rallied 42 points, 1.5%, 2908 at the bell. The S&P 500 rebounded 22 points, 1 2/3%, came to rest at 1356, did the S&P. So it was a positive cap to a fairly dismal week, sadly. Since Monday, the Dow nudged up by a tiny sliver of a percentage point. The NASDAQ sank nearly 1%. The S&P 500 tacked on a 0.1% gain. J.P. Morgan shares jumped nearly 6% today. Stock in Citigroup up nearly 5.5%. Bank of America rose 4.5%. Bond prices slipped. The yield on the 10-year T-note edged up to 1.49%. Think about that for a second. It edged up to 1.5%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on retail sales for June. NASA holds a news conference to discuss Curiosity, the super advanced robot that is slated to land on Mars next month. And on July 16, 1935, the first parking meters were installed in Oklahoma City. Yay! I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The founder and CEO of a company called Peregrine Financial was arrested today. Russell Wassendorf is his name. Peregrine is, or was, I should say, since it filed for bankruptcy protection on Tuesday, it was a commodities futures firm, one that had falsified its financial records to the tune of about $200 million worth of customer funds, some of that money from farmers. Farmers and ranchers who use futures to help manage the risks of being so dependent on Mother Nature. But when their money starts disappearing, can you blame them for being a little bit skeptical? From Harvest Public Media, Jeremy Bernfeld has the story.
If you're a farmer who has bushels of soybeans to sell, you can't just head down to your local grocery store with a truck full of beans. That's where traders at the Chicago Board of Trade come in. It's one of the world's largest agricultural marketplaces. Where you go to sell your corn, soybeans, oats, things like that, it's pretty similar to what stock exchanges look like in the movies. Nestled among the skyscrapers of the Windy City, the Chicago Board of Trade is a long way from the fields. And farmers like Daryl Larson want to keep it that way. Lately, Larson hasn't trusted the markets and the bankers much.
Well, there's basically three places only that I trust people in suits, and that's at church, weddings, and funerals.
Larson is a fourth-generation farmer. He has a small cow-calf operation and farms about 1,600 acres in McPherson in central Kansas. When trading firm MF Global declared bankruptcy in the fall, regulators discovered that $1.6 billion of customer money was missing. A lot of that money belonged to farmers and ranchers, and it made Larson even more wary.
I mean, if they want us to trust them, then they've got to live by the golden rule, and they've got to quit screwing us over when they get a chance to do it.
The markets need farmers like Larson to feel safe. Otherwise, they won't have any commodities to trade. Brian Durkin is the chief operating officer of CME Group, which operates the Chicago Board of Trade. He says the industry is doing its best to reassure farmers.
It is super important. It is a mission on the part of the CME Group to make sure that we are directly reaching out to this very important segment of this business.
By that, he means farmers and ranchers.
I myself, you know, have spent a great deal of my time actually out in the field meeting with those customers that were directly affected from these unfortunate events.
In February, CME Group launched a program designed to back up farmers for up to $25,000 in the event of another MF Global-type situation. But many farmers have accounts worth hundreds of thousands of dollars. The Peregrine Financial bankruptcy will be the first test for the new fund. The industry also wants to show it will be harder for rogue trading firms to dupe them in the future. They're working to institute tougher reporting requirements and greater oversight. Again, Brian Durkin with CME Group.
We want to make sure that the protocols and the procedures are in place that continues to restore their confidence in the industry itself.
Out in Kansas, farmer Daryl Larson has taken to using his local co-op to help him place bets on the markets. It takes out some of the worry, he says. He knows the people he's working with, and he can meet with them face to face. Larson wants to trust the markets in Chicago, and he wants to take some of the risk out of his work. But it's a gradual process.
We need to be able to turn our backs on people and not be afraid they're going to stab us. Just plain and simple.
Farmers know that growing trust, like anything else, is hard. That's a lesson the commodities markets are learning, too. In McPherson, Kansas, I'm Jeremy Bernfeld for Marketplace.
Tomorrow is Bastille Day over in France, commemorating the storming of the French fortress and prison of the same name, one of the key events of the French Revolution. And with all the turmoil happening right now in France and across much of Europe, it kind of seemed like a good day to ask.
What's up?
What's up?
What's up, Europe?
What's up, Europe? Joining us once again is Sophie Petter. She's the Paris Bureau Chief for The Economist magazine. Sophie, it's good to have you back.
A pleasure.
Well, last time we spoke, as I recall, there wasn't much of a mood of discontent, I guess, shall we say, in France, right? There wasn't a whole lot of austerity going on. That has changed, though, this week, hasn't it?
Well, I think that there has been a bit of a change, partly because the government has realized that it's going to have to do something about the deficit, and that's going to involve probably some spending cuts, which are going to be pretty unpleasant. And I think that there's beginning to be a sinking in of the reality, going to have to be some cuts.
And it's not just the government, right? I mean, we saw it this week with Peugeot Citroën, the car maker over there, with like 8,000 layoffs.
That's right. And this has really been the most enormous shock for the French. It's been 20 years since the last car maker closed the factory in France. And this is a very symbolic change. It's a big car plant just north of Paris, very well known. Huge symbolic shock for the French. I really think you can't underestimate how much this is seen both as painful and obviously damaging, but also possibly something of a wake-up call. I mean, I think if there's anything positive that could come out of this, it's the debate that the French have really been reluctant to kind of engage in, and that's about how difficult is it for companies to compete and maintain their production in France when they have such a high labor cost.
Yeah. Speaking of wake-up calls, tomorrow's a big day, right? The anniversary of maybe the biggest wake-up call in history, Bastille Day.
Absolutely. And the French, for this is the one moment when they can celebrate themselves, I suppose. And they have this wonderful sort of parade down the Champs-Élysées. This is a huge, hugely important day for them. It's also the day before they go off on their long summer break. But, you know, this year, François Hollande, the new president, has wanted to make this a sort of, he's trying to be pretty discreet, keep the cost pretty low. But still, the French will be celebrating tomorrow. There's no doubt about that.
Despite all the rain, right? I mean, I read the weather forecast. It's lousy over
well,
there.
It's François Hollande, the new president in France. Almost every single time he's taken any sort of engagement outdoors, every time he gets drenched. So the forecast is exactly the same. His nickname now is Rayman because he can't actually go out and do anything without getting wet. So we're pretty sure it's going to rain here tomorrow, too.
And we won't read anything into that at all. Sophie Petter, she is the Paris Bureau Chief at The Economist magazine. Sophie, thanks.
Okay, no problem.
Bye-bye now. And so, happy early Bastille Day, everybody. And to Kevin Neely, who tweeted us, rather, today, and I quote, is what's up, Europe, the new standard greeting in your offices? Yes, Kevin. Yes, it is. In case you haven't seen the official outfits for the U.S. Olympic team yet, it's what's being called a soft retro look. Red and navy ties, double-breasted jackets for the men, blazers, cream-colored silk skirts for the women, berets for some reason, but I digress on that. Everything will have USA on the front, of course. Made in China on the inside, though, and that, in election year Washington, is what everybody's talking about. From our nation's capital, Marketplace's Scott Tong has the story.
One by one, the politicians march to the microphones, burn the imported clothes, outrageous, disastrous trade policy. Part of the backstory is Olympic teams in rich countries tend to rely on corporate multinational sponsors, in this case, Ralph Lauren. Andrew Zimbalist at Smith College has written several books on sports and economics.
In the advanced capitalist countries where the private sector dominates,
private funding is the rule.
And remember, the Olympics are an international thing.
To object to globalism also in the manufacturing of products that serve the Olympics seems to be ironic, to say the least.
As far as offshoring, clothing brands set sail from America long ago. But the profits, they tend to stay home, says Pietra Rivoli of Georgetown. She wrote, "The Travels of a T-Shirt in the Global Economy."
The big value, it's in the design, it's in the distribution, you know, marketing, all of these are still located in the United States.
But given the political sensitivities, could Ralph Lauren have gone out of its way to make this one batch of Olympic clothes in America? Apparel analyst Adrian Tennant is with Janney Capital.
There would have been a lot of things that would have needed to be overhauled, including the sourcing of the higher-end fabrics. Not really sure if you would end up with exactly the precise quality.
Ooh, low-quality American stuff. And still, the outrage. The question is, will folks complain about foreign sponsors of the U.S. team, like Samsung and Omega? What about Greek yogurt? In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, a follow-up of sorts to our story yesterday about corn. Production, as we mentioned, is down, so prices are up. But what do you think happens when a crop is basically wiped out? That's where Michigan is with its sour cherries, where freak weather has annihilated orchards. Michigan, in case you didn't know, grows most of America's sour cherries, which also, in case you didn't know, goes into granola and trail mix, among other things. So if you're hiking this weekend and you like cherries in your trail mix, enjoy it while it lasts. They're going to be swapping in cranberries soon because of the cost of those cherries. And on that note, we're done on a Friday. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow finally reversed course after six losing sessions. Bounced 203 points higher. The NASDAQ up 42 points. That's nearly 1.5%. The S&P 500 up 22 points, 1.75%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Sitara Nieves. The executive producer of the broadcast is Deborah Clark. J.J. Yore is the vice president and general manager around these parts. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, you ready to coin a phrase?
We've heard about the sandwich generation where the parents are having to take care of their parents and then their children.
Right.
Now they're taking care of their grandkids as well. I call it the club sandwich generation. You got to add another layer in there.
Aging and the costs thereof. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you back here on Monday. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.